I'd like to introduce our speaker, Dr. Michael W. Camerota, who's an attending physician in the cardiology practice here at Boca Regional. His graduate work at University of Florida and his internship at University of North Carolina, as well as his residency at University of North Carolina and his fellowship in cardiology at Wake Forest Baptist Hospital in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. His topic this morning is percutaneous coronary intervention, an update for the non-cardiologist. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Camerota.
Okay, thank you. As an interventional cardiologist, to be asked to come and talk about percutaneous coronary interventions in an hour span is kind of a daunting task. So what I've done is I've really created a talk that's at a fairly basic level, sort of gives most of the updates for what non-cardiologists need to know, and then thought that I would leave a little bit of time at the end for discussion so that if anyone has any personal questions about this is an example of something I came across, what should be done here, or what's this, that you should feel free to ask at that point. Let's see, does this work? I guess so. Okay. So, to start off, you know, just to talk about the background and sort of an introduction into coronary artery disease, just to refresh everybody. Some of us are in med school, but some of us have been out of medical school for a while, so just a little bit of a brief update there. Through patient selection, stent selection, what's probably most interesting to most of the people in this room would be the post-stent therapy and the future directions, which we'll leave towards the end. That's the more interesting part of the talk. All right. So if you recall back to your days of, and I don't know if there's, okay, back to your days in medical school, coronary atherosclerosis is a gradual process. It begins in the teenage years, usually because people eat cheeseburgers, french fries, their parents gave them poor genetics, those sorts of things. You start off with aggregation, fatty lipids, which allow macrophages and monocytes to enter into the lipid-filled plaque, which grows over time due to various different factors. Aggregation can become unstable, lead to thrombosis, which is what we know as an acute coronary syndrome, or can be stable and calcified, which can lead to chronic or more stable coronary artery disease. On a more molecular level, again, this all starts with the lipids being in the intima. You get a lot of the white cell lines aggregating, going across into the intima of the vessel wall, turning into macrophages, phagocytosing these little lipid particles, becoming foam cells, and then ultimately dying there in the plaque due to apoptosis and things to that matter. What's not shown here is actually that smooth muscle cells play a large role in also becoming foam cells and leading to progression of the atherosclerotic disease. Again, if any of this is too basic or redundant, you guys can just yell out and tell me, dude, move on, we've heard this before. So what does this lead to? And some of the younger people in the audience may not have used this book, but I'm guessing that a lot of the attendings know exactly what this picture is. And this was a Frank Netter drawing out of Netter's Anatomy, and is also in Netter's Heart Disease. And this is the prototypical picture of what happens when your arteries clog. You know, they didn't have fancy machinery or anything like that back then. Netter really drew this picture, and I don't think he really understood how much of coronary artery disease he captured in this picture. So you have a over 55-year-old man walking out of a restaurant, meaning that his diet is probably pretty poor, eats out a lot, has a lot of lipids, probably has other risk factors, maybe hypertension. Clearly, he's a smoker. He dropped his cigarette to clutch his chest, so that certainly plays a role into some of this. And I don't even think when Netter was drawing this that they had identified that smoking was truly a large cardiovascular risk factor. And he's outside in the snow, which is, you know, the typical presentation of somebody coming in with angina. I was outside shoveling snow, chopping wood in the cold. These sort of things can exacerbate it. So this picture brings to light what you should be looking at in a patient that you think might have angina. And what exactly is angina? It is defined as a syndrome of paroxysmal, meaning it comes and it goes, constricting pain below the sternum, precipitated by exertion or excitement, and caused by the ischemia of heart muscle, usually due to coronary artery disease or blockage. Further differentiating angina into stable and unstable angina, really the stable coronary syndromes, which is just, as we spoke before, a stable plaque causing constriction of blood flow to the heart muscle tissue, versus an unstable plaque, which means that there's been a rupture, thrombus formation, and there's more acuteness, acute ischemia, rapid chest pain, those sorts of things. With the acute coronary syndromes, decision-making's a little bit easier here when you have an acute coronary syndrome than it is when you have a stable coronary syndrome. But both are clearly indications for revascularization at some point. So how do we evaluate people with those stable coronary syndromes? I think most of us realize with the unstable coronary syndromes or the acute coronary syndromes and stable anginas, you know, the patient comes into the ER, they've got chest pain, they have a troponin elevation, that's someone that needs to go to the cath lab. I mean, it's pretty straightforward thinking process. But in terms of somebody with stable ischemic heart disease, now this is someone that just comes into your office and says, you know, I get this sort of stable chest pain when I'm up walking around, and it tends to go away when I stop walking around. What's going on? And so when you're evaluating these people, you want to make sure that they actually do have what you would consider angina, that it's not just I've got sharp chest pain, when I lay down at night I get burning chest pain, you know, things like that that make it a little bit less typical. You want to differentiate some of that stuff out of this before you even move on to further testing. And then one of the main things that we do is we stress test. Someone has a reasonably good story for angina. Usually it's not perfectly classic. You want to see if there's some sort of inducible ischemia, and the way to do that is through stress testing. So again, we're trying to stress this lesion by requiring more blood flow to go through it during exertion, which can't happen because there's a constant constricted lesion. So once you've got your stress test, you get these findings that you have no idea what they mean. You know, there's, you know, a small area of inducible ischemia. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean the patient should automatically go to the cath lab and get a stent placed? They've got symptoms. The stent would probably reduce their symptoms, but is that really the way to go? And so we have these appropriate use criteria that people actually put forth in the American Heart Association. And you can see when you're talking about patients coming in, having stress tests, if they have low risk findings on non-invasive testing, for the most part, the patient really shouldn't be going to the cath lab unless they're having those symptoms continuously on a two-drug anti-anginal regimen, and we'll get to exactly what that means in a second. excuse me. Same for even intermediate and high-risk findings. You'll see that there it may be appropriate. It's not a slam dunk taking this person in and going and put a stent in. The only time it's truly a slam dunk to do this is when the patient has a two-drug anti-anginal regimen. And now, these are for people with certain lower-risk lesions on the calf. When you have higher-risk lesions in your proximal LAD or a proximal left dominant circumflex vessel or something to that effect, again, you're still looking at, now you're not all the way down at the bottom, but you still might be appropriate, and appropriate, again, when you're on a two-drug anti-angiogenal regimen and you have either high-risk findings on a one-drug anti-angiogenal regimen or the two drugs, and you either don't have a stress test but you have classic symptoms, or you have those low-risk findings. So just to keep that in mind, because when you think about who's going to come into the cath lab and who's going to end up getting stented, the patient on the cath lab table is the patient that should already have an indication for having revascularization of some sort when they're there. Otherwise, you're putting the patient at risk for a procedure without the potential benefit of some sort of resolution or therapy being performed. Let's see. So there's that box. So these slides are a little bit easier, and again, I said this is sort of the more straightforward part. So this is determining, who with non-ST elevation, ACS, unstable angina, non-STEMI, and then obviously STEMI is even more clear-cut than this, but who should be getting stents. And really, there's an indication for almost anybody. This is how to actually evaluate these people. Truthfully, you want the 12-lead EKG, you want the serial troponins, you want them to have symptoms, you want to use your risk scores, your heart score, your GRACE scores, TIMI risk score, all these things that help you evaluate the risk benefit of patients getting revascularization. And then, lower down on the list, getting a BNP or something like that. But really, I think this is a topic for a different day, but really how to evaluate ACS. I think most people, especially in this room, because I recognize most of the residents, should have a fairly reasonable understanding of what goes into that. So as I said, once you've diagnosed someone with one of these unstable coronary syndromes, it's a much easier task of saying, oh yeah, okay, this person should go to the cath lab, this person should get a stent. So back to that anti-angiogenal regimen we were talking about, and that, this is one of those things that can be a little bit difficult to wrap your mind around. You've got a patient with chest pain in your office who had a positive stress test, and you're gonna spend some time out there putting them on a beta blocker, a calcium channel blocker, a long-acting nitrate, Ranexa, these sorts of things. And they're not going to be happy with you. They're going to say, why are you doing this to me? And part of the answer is the stent's not going to save your life. This is something that we have known for some time in stable coronary syndromes. All it's going to do is relieve your symptoms, and if we can do that without putting you at risk for the heart catheterization, then that's something that we probably should be at least trying to do. So most patients should be on these medications, and at the goal doses, from metoprolol, you're really trying to get them up to 100 milligrams BID, if they can tolerate that from a blood pressure perspective or a pulse perspective. Same thing with calcium channel blockers, same thing with the nitrates. The limiting factor I found with the nitrates is really people getting headaches. It seems to be pretty disabling. And then Ranexa, the dosing's pretty easy, but up to 1,000 milligrams. So now into sort of the meat of the conversation, stents and the development of stents over time. And this is really a fairly recent development when you think about the course of medical history. You've got really the first angiography being performed in the late 1950s. Think about that. My parents were born there, and a lot of the attendings that are around were alive when the first angiography was performed. Okay, you got off-pump revascularization in the 60s, venous grafts for CABG later in the 60s, radial grafts for CABG. So you see, you went from angiography immediately to bypass surgery. This is usually the way things go. The surgeons figure out how to fix a problem long before us simple folk actually figure out how to do it without cutting people open. Then in The 1970s, late 1970s, a man named Andreas Grunzig came up with the first balloon catheter that was able to go in and actually blow up the artery from the inside to take care of some of these blockages. You get the first coronary stents in the 80s, first drug-eluting stents in the 2000s, and then up in the 20-teens, some of the bioresorbable scaffolds, and we'll get to all that here in just a second. So back to Andreas Grunzig, very, very innovative man, developed this balloon. It was a very simple balloon stuck on the end of a catheter. It was just guided in. You had to steer the balloon itself across the lesion. You had to inflate the balloon. You had to leave it up for a long period of time. Patients would have chest pain, but this was the first time that you could actually start treating someone with an acute MI, someone that for some other reason was not a good candidate for bypass. And it was met with success. It was the initial percutaneous therapy. It had problems. Anytime you come up with a new technique, the initial stages, you're always going to have problems. There was a high rate of restenosis. As you can think about this, that artery that we saw back in the beginning had that layer of smooth muscle around it. You've now blown a balloon up and stretched out this smooth muscle layer, which has elastin in it, and you deflate the balloon, what happens? The artery collapses back down on itself, and you get a restenotic lesion due to recoil, and then, you know, it's restenotic, so over time it closes back off almost completely. There was a high rate of reintervention in the 30 to 50% range, high rate of having to go to surgery because of complications. This would be like taking your car to the mechanic after you get in a car wreck, and he makes sure it runs, but the body work is still not done, so you're driving down the street and there's pieces flying all over the place. You know, truthfully, you are in there and you're blowing up a balloon in a lesion and you create a dissection. As we all know, coronary dissections can be a bad thing. So you're sitting there hoping that this dissection's going to heal over, that it, you know, you're going to have them on enough blood thinning medicines that this is going to be okay. But there was a high rate of having to go back in and fix things or going to surgery. The rate of coronary dissection already talked about. This was very widely available early on, but we knew we needed something else. Too many people were going to surgery. Too many people were going back for reintervention. You left sheaths in these people overnight in their leg while they were in bed because you knew that a high proportion of these people, you're just going to have to go right back in and do something. So with that, I seem to have missed a slide here. So, or they got out of order. We developed stents, and this is not the first stent that was developed. This is one of the early stents. This is something called the Palmaz-Schatz stent. And this is the first thing that sort of resembles what we use today as stents. It was bare metal, stainless steel. You can see all these cells are closed within themselves. And these two sections of stent are basically connected to each other by this little hinge in between. This thing would be like incredibly difficult to cross across a lesion. It's very thick, it's very non-movable, so in order to move it into maybe a tight place or something like that, it'd be very difficult to get in there, and it was met with a lot of difficulty. You had to have large sheaths, big support, big holes in arteries, but it did a reasonably good job. The initial paper that came out and looked at the feasibility of the Palmaz-Schatz stent, they came up with the conclusion that it almost completely eliminates the decrease in vessel dimensions caused by elastic recoil and diminishes the impact of hyperplasia and reduces the rates of restenosis. I mean, that all sounds great. You look at the difference when they actually looked at putting this in versus balloon angioplasty, and you see that target lesion revascularization, 10% versus 21%. That is an 11% absolute risk reduction. That means you have to treat 9 patients to see a good result from putting in one of these stents. And this is a stent from early on. That's kind of a big deal. But again, It was hard to deliver. It was a crude device. It wasn't something that was very facile, easy to put in. It took people a long time to get them in. And so we came up with the second generation bare metal stents all the way through. Actually, this should say driver, not integrity. Sorry about that. And these are more highly engineered stents, thinner struts. You can see they now have what we call an open cell design, most of them. And I'm not covering every single stent that's made. I'm just covering what you would most likely see during your practice. You're out there, you're seeing patients. What are you most likely to see nowadays in terms of patients having something in their coronaries? They move from stainless steel to these chromium and platinum alloys. And the struts were thin enough that these stents were now able to go across lesions a little bit better. You can see here that the cells aren't closed, which makes the stent a lot more flexible. So if you have a curve in an artery, it can sit there. It doesn't irritate the artery quite as much. Some of them are cut out of solid tubes of metal. Some of them are actually individual wires that are strung all the way around and welded together. But you look at these things and you have multiple trials or registries that were performed to look at the efficacy of using these stents in patients. You know, in 2003, you're seeing these coming out, trials and registries of 300 patients, 11% target lesion revascularization, which looked great, great in comparison, and that's at 270 days. So you're thinking, wow, this is good, we're moving in the right direction. Same thing for the other stents. You know, you have a driver registry, and again, 300 patients, and 7% target vessel revascularization. And then you've got the Omega trial, 300 patients, 7% target vessel revascularization. You start seeing this. You start seeing, as we get further into the progression, we start seeing this thing called stent thrombosis. And that's something that could become a problem. And we'll talk about that when we get to drug-eluting stents a little bit more in depth. Bare metal stents were pretty good. You know, they endothelialized fairly rapidly. The vessel walls grew over the stent. Metal was no longer exposed to blood, less risk of thrombogenicity at that point. Low rates of stent thrombosis. There is a higher rate of restenosis compared to drug-eluting stents. We'll talk about that in a second. And nowadays, for the most part, these are still being used and mostly indicated in patients that might have adherence issues or upcoming surgeries, reasons that they can't take dual antiplatelet therapy for long term. This gets back to the endothelialization. You can see that the darker columns are bare metal stents, whether it be stainless steel stent or cobalt chromium stents. And then the lighter lines here are the drug-eluting stents. And you can see that after 7 days, these bare metal stents tend to be about 98% endothelialized. So this gets to some of the points where you know that after a month, we take patients off of dual antiplatelet therapy when they have bare metal stents in place. This is why. After a week, technically, you should be getting close to the point where you might be able to take them off. But you still had patients with restenosis. You know, bare metal stents were good, but they were sort of an annuity plan. Patients kept coming back further out, target vessel or target lesions being revascularized. And someone had the great idea of trying to put drug on top of these stents. There's several generations of drug-eluting stents, but before we get into all that, we're going to talk about what are the components of a drug-eluting stent. And first, there's the scaffold. You've seen the scaffold. Those bare metal stents that we just reviewed serve as scaffolds for drug-eluting stents. On top of that, there's a polymer, whether it's a permanent polymer or a bioresorbable polymer, that has the drug inside of it that elutes into the vessel wall. Purpose of the drug is to stop the vessel wall from restenosing. In the process of doing that, you end up killing off intimal cells and changing the dynamics of how intimal cells grow, and you slow down endothelialization because the cells that are directly contacting the stent are also affected by the drug that's in there. So the first drug-eluting stent that came out was the Cypher stent. It's a sirolimus-eluting stent. Sirolimus is a drug that most of you have at least heard of. It's an oral drug that's used as an immune modulator. It had pretty good results. You can see that when you compare the drug-eluting stent to the control, you have less target lesion revascularization, 5% versus 20% over the course of a year. Less need for CABG, less need for target lesion PCI. You have a lower rate of MACE, the combined outcome of multiple cardiovascular risk endpoints. And actually, in most of these early trials, you'll see the stent thrombosis rate was not much higher. And in this case, it wasn't higher at all. This is the survival curve, sirolimus-eluting stent at the top, bare metal stent at the bottom, and you can see over the course of 360 days, there's a very significant difference in how many of these stents are actually remaining open. The second stent that came out shortly thereafter was the Taxus stent, and you had very similar results here. Comparing to bare metal stent, you can see the target lesion revascularization, 4 versus 15%, repeat coronary intervention, significantly lower, bypass, significantly lower, and where is the stent thrombosis? Again, it's actually lower than the bare metal stent. So we should put these in everybody. We should put it in the water, right? And here's just the graphical form of that. You can see that like everything looks better with these first-generation drug-eluting stents. And I'll tell you, I still see patients coming in with drug-eluting stents that were put in the early stages of drug-eluting stents. These things are still open. These things worked. They kept the vessels open for a long time. But then we started to see this. First-generation drug-eluting stents and stent thrombosis late after implantation. Now, what does late after implantation mean? That means we were treating these people with Plavix and aspirin for a year and taking them off. And then these people were getting stent thrombosis 2 years out, 3 years out. These stents were so good at inhibiting the vessel from regrowing that the stent struts were still exposed to the bloodstream 2 and 3 years later. So there's actually an indication for these people to still be on antiplatelet therapy as long as you can possibly tolerate it in them. Again, this is all suspected to be due to decreased endothelialization, continued exposure of the stent to the bloodstream. As you can see, this was from an editorial that was done, and this is the theoretical modeling that they said was going on, but you can see that with the drug-eluting stents, you sort of sit on average at the lower end of endothelialization for the bare metal stents. So on average, you're slow, which means that the ones that are really slow are really going to be the ones that are in trouble because they're not going to re-endothelialize their stents. Some people will endothelialize just fine, but others may have these things just completely exposed to the bloodstream for a long period of time. So a second generation of drug-eluting stent was created. The drug that they used was everolimus. The other one that is also seen in practice is called zotorolimus. And they compared these stents in a randomized fashion to these first generation. This is the paclitaxel stent, the Taxus stent that we talked about, that second first-generation drug-eluting stent that came out. And you can see there's a big difference in everything when you compare target lesion failure, target lesion revascularization, to stent thrombosis, all the way through these second-generation drug-eluting stents are doing better. And then even beyond that, there's now a third generation, although we don't technically call it that because it still uses the everolimus stent everolimus drug, which is called the Synergy stent. It's produced by Boston Scientific, and this is the first of the newer generation of stents that are using a bioresorbable polymer. Now, where the older stents were using a permanent polymer or a very slowly resorbing polymer with the drug in it, which meant that the drug was eluting for a long period of time, 6 months, a year, 2 years, these bioresorbable polymers supposedly disappear within about 3 months or so. So the drug is delivered there the first 3 months. The drug is then gone, and you should be able to get endothelialization shortly thereafter, which is, in theory, the best of both worlds. You've reduced your neointimal proliferation, and you've allowed endothelialization of the stent. This is the holy grail, right? Well, they would have you think so. So this is just a picture, shows you the drug polymer coating. The other thing that they do here, which is kind of interesting and doesn't completely make sense to me, is the abluminal coating of the polymer, so the drug is only on the surface of that opposes the artery. To me, I'm not really sure that that makes that much of a difference, because if you're inhibiting the artery from endothelializing, you're inhibiting it from endothelializing, whether you're inhibiting it all the way around the strut or not. But regardless, it bioresorbs. It's very good. It's thin. It's trackable. And as far as we can tell, it actually does better than our second generation systems in terms of having stent thrombosis. You can still get stent thrombosis, obviously, but you can see with our older generation, and this is in the first year, actually this is the first 30 days, you can see the second generation had at least two, if not five, stent thrombosis versus maybe one. They're not sure. I hate it when they say probable stent thrombosis. Let's just not even get into that. And then this one, very late out, this was just someone came off their drug and had, I think it was at 2 years in this study, this patient had a stent thrombosis. This patient here, it was actually really interesting because they underwent another procedure, which we'll get to in a second, which was actually a drug-coated balloon in Europe, and then they had a stent thrombosis afterwards. So we're not really entirely certain we can count that patient because they were way off label in this study. But these are pretty good. You know, we're still waiting to see some of the newer data on these. On these stents and how they truly pan out over time. You can see there's really no difference so far in target lesion failure. There's no difference in target lesion revascularization with these stents. Really, this is just aimed at these third generations trying to stave off that stent thrombosis issue that we saw with the earlier generations of stents. So what are the issues with putting in a stent? You've got metal in your artery. I'd say that's probably the biggest issue. Your artery can't go back to functioning the way a normal artery does. If you need to re-intervene, if there is restenosis, it still can happen. It's a much lower rate with drug-eluting stents, but it still can happen. You have to put in a second layer of stent. Each layer of stent that you put in increases the rate of restenosis, so you get up to two layers. All of a sudden, your stent's not lasting quite as long as you would want it to. Now you've got a stent there. How are you going to bypass it? So if the patient does need to go for bypass, now there's a stent there, it's more difficult to get in and actually do the bypass. They have to find a target. They can't cut through a stent. You can't extract the stent without completely macerating the artery. So the metal in the artery does pose a significant limitation in what we do. The other thing that happens with stents being in place, as I'm sure many of you have recently realized, is someone comes in with atypical chest pain, you order a coronary CAT scan. they tell you the arteries are clean, except we can't tell what's inside the stent. So it didn't really help because you were most suspicious of whether or not the stent was the problem in the first place. So the stents actually being there can impair some of our imaging modalities. So the guys at Abbott Vascular thought, boy, wouldn't it be great if we could get that stent to disappear over time. The most notable variation of this is the Abbott Vascular Absorbed Stent, but there are also multiple newer stent scaffolds. Remember back to the three parts of a drug-eluting stent, the scaffold, the polymer, the drug. Now we're talking about the scaffolds. How do you get rid of that piece of metal that's sitting in the artery? And there's multiple different trials and trying to see if there's, first of all, a metallic-based scaffold that might resorb over time. The most promising compounds are magnesium and zinc-based metallic alloys. There's been some reasonably good data in Europe as to these stents being in place and dissolving inside the body over the course of about a year. Abbott Vascular, as I said, put out the Absorb Stent, which was a polylactic acid polymer. So basically, you've got plastic that dissolves over time. And did fairly well. You can see that it was non-inferior, but not as good as the metallic scaffolds that we had used in the past. But remember what I told you back in the beginning with plain old balloon angioplasty. When you first come out with something, you haven't highly engineered the devices, the procedure, in order to optimize success. So now we're comparing what's a, you know, multi-year developmental process and a multi-generation stenting system to a new first-generation, thicker stent strut, unproven system. I think they did pretty well. If you'd compared this to the old Taxus stents, these things would be put in like that every single day. But because we had something better already, unfortunately, it had to be pulled from the market because there were some issues with stent fracture or scaffold fracture. Again, it's plastic. You can't blow it up as hard as a metal stent. And there were some issues with stent thrombosis or scaffold thrombosis further down the line that they were running into. So they pulled it from the market. I don't think because they had to. I think they just didn't want the bad publicity that was going along with it. And I'm pretty sure they're in development of a second generation of this, which is probably going to be coming out in the near future. But they're going to have to compete with some of the metallic bioabsorbable scaffold systems that are coming out. And this brings us to probably what everyone in the room cares about, so I'm sorry I wasted your time with the first part of the talk, which is, what do you need to know and what do you need to do with the patients after I've put a stent in them? And it depends. This is a very busy slide, and I'm sorry about that. I could talk for about 30 days on this slide, but I'm going to try and break it down as quickly as I can. So that we don't all fall asleep. So obviously your patient just got PCI and they come back up to the floor. What do you need to know about how to treat that patient? Well, it depends. Were they an acute coronary syndrome or were they a stable ischemic heart disease patient? If they were an acute coronary syndrome patient, they have an indication for having dual antiplatelet therapy for a full year. That vessel is inflamed, that vessel is sick, it's upset, they need to be on dual antiplatelet therapy for 1 year, and that's to prevent further episodes from the ACS. If I didn't put a stent in, they would have to be on dual antiplatelet therapy for a year. So there's no difference if I put a stent in that patient. The only caveats there, patient's a high risk, starts bleeding, something like that. There is a class 2B indication to be able to stop their Plavix or Brilinta after 6 months. If they're not high risk, they go out to a year, And there's actually a reasonably good indication that if they're not bleeding, not having issues with the dual antiplatelet regimen, keep them on it for at least 30 months. That's the data we have. Came out of the DAPT trial. Basically, what you do is you trade off bleeding risk for a reduced MI rate. Comes out as a wash, so usually I say if they're not having problems with bleeding, you're probably getting a benefit from a coronary standpoint. Now, the more difficult patients are these ones that are in the stable ischemic heart disease. You know why we put in bare metal stents. We talked about how fast these stents endothelialize. Off of Plavix in a month. The patients love you. They think you're great. They don't have to take extra medications until they have to have their stent re-intervened on because it has restenosed because there was no drug in the stent to begin with. Conversely, in the drug-eluting stent placement arm, if the patient is truly a high risk, and we'll get to some of the trials that are coming out to prove this, but truly a high risk, they can come off of Brilinta at about 3 months. You don't want to do it. You don't feel comfortable with it, but some of these stents actually have a CE mark for 3 month dual antiplatelet therapy, and the CE mark is basically the FDA approval of Europe. So there is some evidence to suggest that if they come off at 3 months, they'll probably be okay. Preferred at least 6 months, preferred to a year, and then again, the same situation, you can leave them on for up to 30 months to reduce the risk of MI. And that's my general spiel on this busy slide. So which dual antiplatelet therapy should you be using? Well, generally your interventional cardiologist is going to make that decision for you. But if for some reason he puts in a stent, forgets to put in orders, turns off his phone and goes on vacation, you should know that ticagrelor, prasugrel are more efficacious than clopidogrel. We know it. They reduce stent thrombosis. They do a better job, and they do such a better job that patients actually bleed more. So you need to realize that higher efficacy, higher bleeding risk. But in this case, if you can get them at least that first 30 days, that's probably the best thing that you could do. Prasugrel has some caveats to it, which are a little bit beyond the scope of our talk today, but really just avoid it in anybody with a history of stroke or elderly, which since you're in Boca Raton means you should just take the drug out of your arsenal altogether, because I think that everyone is either elderly or has had a stroke around here. At least that's what I've run into. Brilinta is a great medication and tends to be most of our go-to medications, and then Plavix is the old tried and true. Again, the benefit out to 30 months is balanced by the bleeding risk. And if your patient happens to have atrial fibrillation, which again, you're in Boca Raton, so probably have a high rate of your patients having dual antiplatelet therapy need after stenting, but also needing to be on a blood thinner, whether it be a warfarin or a direct oral anticoagulant, your bleeding risk is going to be increased 2 to 3-fold by doing triple therapy over something like warfarin. So if the bleeding risk is low, if this is a young, otherwise healthy, non-bleeding patient, do the triple therapy for a month. If they can tolerate it, do it. If not, then you can consider the use of just the P2Y12 inhibitor, the Brilinta or the Plavix, in combination with therapeutic anticoagulation with warfarin, or either the dual or the direct oral anticoagulant. And there are trials to support doing this. Most of us still feel comfortable, if possible, doing triple therapy, at least in the lower risk populations. And speaking of bleeding, we get to a newer topic, which has become the focus in the recent past, which is now that you've got your patient upstairs, you've decided to put them on antiplatelet therapy and or blood thinning medications, and they have a hole in them. It's either in their leg or it's in their wrist. Over the last about 10 years now, radial artery access for catheterization has been increasing in popularity across the United States for multiple reasons, but mostly due to patient comfort, preference, and risk of vascular complications. As you can imagine, a whole lot easier to put your finger on your wrist than it is to mash your fist in someone's groin, and a whole lot more comfortable if you have to do it. In addition, there is some mortality benefit of the radial approach during ACS, which is mostly attributed to the decreased bleeding complication risk. And so most of us that want to use the radial approach in our STEMI patients will use it in all of our patients just so that we're facile when we have to be fast with it. We want to be fast with it and ready to go. But it brings up a whole new set of issues in terms of how to take care of the patient after the cath. And you'll see your patient come up with a device that looks something like this. I refuse to show the device that the hospital here uses just because I don't believe in the product being as good as the one that's depicted here. But it's a pretty simple device. There's a balloon inside of a tight-fitting cuff, gets blown up, holds pressure, saves your fingers from 2 hours of holding pressure. Over the course of 2 to 3 hours, they remove a little bit of air every 15 minutes or so till all the air's out. Then they take the band off, wrap it up, and you're good to go. The patient's sitting up. They're eating. Really, this is just very minimal work for anyone other than the nursing staff to take care of. And if it does start bleeding again, you just add more air to stop the bleeding. Or you hold pressure. You can always inflate a blood pressure cuff or something to that effect if for some reason the bleeding's uncontrolled and you have to reapply one of these things. But I would recommend calling your cardiologist who put the thing on in the first place. Your patients should have light duty with the wrist for the rest of the day. In the hospital, they'll leave the brace on, but it doesn't really need to be left on. They just shouldn't be, you know, really doing much with it for the rest of the day. And then after that, we'll talk about after that. The femoral access, I think you're all a little bit more familiar with. Patients on bed rest, they're unhappy, they get pressure in their groin. Then after several hours, they can dangle their feet over the side of the bed. Then again, after several hours, they can get up and walk around, and at that point, they start chasing you down, asking you for food. Regardless of your access site, all your patients should not lift anything more than 10 pounds for 1 week. I had to add these two for Boca Raton because it seems like no one lives here without wanting to go back to playing tennis or golf within the first 2 days after a procedure. No soaking in water, so baths, pools, beaches, dishes, mopping. The wives hate me when I tell them this. No driving. The time limit depends on the cardiologist and the access site. I usually tell patients if you can get away with not driving for a week, you probably should, just because if you get in a car wreck and something happens to your access site and you bleed out, we haven't done you any good. So having your wrist up on the steering wheel, for me, the radial cath stuff is a little bit more time-wise in terms of staying away from driving just because your hands are physically on the steering wheel. Showering is okay. After you've told them they can't take a bath, they all get worried that they're going to smell pretty bad after about 7 days. And then, as I alluded to earlier, and these are things that you're all going to be looking for coming up in the next few years, but this is some registry data from out of Europe, which got the Xience stent, one of those second-generation drug-eluting stents, a 3-month dual antiplatelet therapy mark. And what they did is they had a registry of all the patients that got this stent, and then they just looked back and looked at which ones stopped their antiplatelets before 3 months and just looked at to see how many of them died, didn't do well. I think this is the kicker. What no one was expecting was that these people stopped their antiplatelet therapy before 3 months, and not a single individual in the registry had stent thrombosis at a year. I found that a little bit hard to believe, but I think it at least gives you some hypothesis generation. Obviously, the Europeans are a little bit more liberal in terms of their guidelines, so they reduced their dual antiplatelet therapy regimen recommendations to 3 months. We haven't done that yet in the United States. We're still at the at least 6 months for the stable ischemic heart disease patients, but this is coming. These are all the trials that are currently enrolling to look at short dual antiplatelet therapy. 3 months for Xience, 1 month for the Resolute stent, 1 month for Synergy, 3 months for Synergy. This 1 month is for elderly population. They coined it the senior trial, which is always nice. This is one we're going to have to look for in Boca Raton. And then one that I don't have up here because it hasn't been registered yet, but Xience actually also has a 1 month dual antiplatelet therapy trial going on. So, you know, year 2020 is when a lot of these things are going to come out. That means 2 years, we're going to start seeing trials reporting the data off of patients that had 1 month to 3 months of dual antiplatelet therapy with a drug-eluting stent. So when that data comes out, and I suspect it'll be positive data, you're going to see bare metal stents disappear. Okay? That's my prediction. But I don't think that these companies would put the time and effort into this if they didn't think that it was going to be a positive positive effect for them. And once one did it, of course, they all had to do it because they didn't want to be the one stent that didn't have an indication for having it. For the patients that have stents in place and you don't want to continue to put layers of stent in because the patients will restenose over time, there's also drug-coated balloons that are coming out. We talked about that a little bit earlier in that Synergy trial with that late stent thrombosis. But this is basically just one of those old-fashioned balloons. It has a polymer and a drug on the balloon. It gets blown up in place, leaves the drug and polymer behind, and goes away. No stents left behind, just drug and polymer. So a lot of us see this as really promising for those patients that already have stents in place that restenose. So you get to go ahead, go in, open the thing up, and recoat it with drug, which is very nice for us. There's been some good results of these things in the peripheral sphere. The problem that I see with them in the coronary sphere is they're not going to be a really great indication for de novo coronary disease. Remember, you're creating a dissection. If you don't want to have a dissection, you have to leave your balloon up for 3 to 5 minutes, and you can do that in a leg, but I haven't seen a leg fibrillate in several years, so I think that's probably okay in a leg. It's probably not going to be as okay in a coronary, which is going to leave you in the realm of restenotic lesions, but it's certainly, with all the patients out there that have stents in place and the rate of restenosis that we know happens, this is something that's going to be, I think, useful in our repertoire in the near future. The fact that you're not leaving stent struts behind obviates the need for long-term antiplatelet therapy, but when you balloon a stent and you leave a polymer on it, I'm guessing there's going to be struts exposed. If it were me, I'd leave the patient on the dual antiplatelet therapy as long as I could after having a drug-coated balloon blown up in their stent. And that just about covers it. I think I ran just about on time. And then we're open for discussions, any burning questions, anything that you guys have been wondering for a long time, or burning irritations with your interventional cardiologist regarding your patients who get stents. Yes, sir.
Okay, so your algorithm that you presented initially suggests that somebody comes to the primary care, has angina that's stable, and goes to the cardiologist, has a stress test that's positive.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're supposed to start medication.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So let's say he goes for catheterization.
Yep.
Then they have this fractionated flow study. And even though the patient has angina and a lesion, if that's not significant, it's being unstented. And then the patient leaves the cath lab still with a lesion with angina.
Mm-hmm. I actually completely agree with you. That's a great question, because the point of the FFR is an on-the-table stress test, right? You did the stress test in your office. It was positive. you've proven that that lesion is a significant lesion. It's causing ischemia. So, you know, back to our appropriate use criteria. Let's say this was not a high-risk lesion, okay? And low-risk findings or even intermediate or high-risk findings. If your patient's not on antianginal therapy, they should probably be sent out of the cath lab without having a stent put in. And they should probably be started on medication for antianginals. If that patient has a high-risk lesion, proximal LAD or proximal left dominant circ, if they're on antianginal regimen, they should definitely get it. And probably, if they're at least on one drug, maybe not if they're not on any antianginal therapy. But this gets me back to the point that I was trying to make before, which was when the patient comes to the cath lab, they should already have an appropriate indication for PCI, or at least be in the realm of having that. So the FFR, the fractional flow reserve, I think is very useful, especially for patients that you say to yourself in the office, I think this is angina, to the extent that I wouldn't trust my stress test if it were negative. And now I have them in the cath lab, and here's a lesion that looks borderline. So really, only in those cases where you're saying this probably shouldn't be causing this patient's symptoms, and I want to make sure that this is something that's significant before I do it. If you have a stress test that's positive, let's say your anterior wall was positive, suggesting an LAD lesion, but you get in the cath lab, the patient had typical anginal symptoms, and it's a circumflex lesion that you can't explain by that stress test or something to that effect. Or the LAD is clearly obstructed, but the circumflex vessel has a borderline lesion on it, and you want to know if they should go to bypass instead of getting a stent placed. These are sort of the realm where they should get the FFR performed. But FFR, just like anything else, it's a predictive tool. It's not perfect. We set a cutoff for what we think is an appropriate level of inducible ischemia. So if you get your fractional flow reserve to 0.8 or lower, we call it positive. What about that guy that's at 0.81? He could be having anginal symptoms from it. So it's not a perfect test, and I agree with you completely. But I think that if we look at this as the patient should be making it to the table with an indication for PCI already, that's why we're doing the cath in the first place, I think you'd see a lot less FFR. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes, sir.
So now I have to deal with patients with GIP all the time.
Yes, you do. That's the person that I would get away from. Everything that could cause them to have irritation in their gut along with it. So these are patients that, instead of having them on dual therapy, and again, for the TIA, it's a little bit different story because there's really no benefit to dual antiplatelet therapy as far as we know in terms of stroke prevention, those sorts of things. I mean, we do it because it makes us feel better, but there's really not a whole lot of data behind that. But let's say your patient had a stent 6 months ago, upper GI bleed, they're on dual antiplatelet therapy, you go in, bad gastritis or there's something there, you stop the dual antiplatelet therapy, the bleeding gets better. That's the patient I would take off aspirin and leave on Plavix.
Is it Plavix?
It is a better antiplatelet drug than aspirin, and it also doesn't come with the same GI sequela that aspirin does, as you know. You know, higher dose aspirin, more GI irritation, more likely to bleed. Sometimes those people bleed anyway. If you can get them out to 6 months, that would be great. But again, I think that it's a good question. There's no perfect answer for that. So the high-risk patients are the ones that you look at and say this is a high-risk patient. You know, you're sort of elderly, more frail, someone who's had a history of GI bleeding. But we can ask the gastroenterologists in the room, if someone's not GI bleeding now and you do a colonoscopy or an endoscopy, are you likely to find a source for future bleeding?
No.
Right.
Decide whether you put them on antiplatelet therapy. If you can find an ulcer that hasn't bled, and then you know they may well bleed, you put them on antiplatelet.
Yeah, but I think then you're talking about
the question is
multiple procedures and risk.
If someone's bled before, that's an easy one.
Yep.
It's kind of a no brainer, but otherwise
right.
We don't have a good answer.
I always find that the patient has a stent and then they go for like a skin biopsy or something.
Yeah. I have a disagreement with the dentists in terms of tooth extractions. I think patients should not have tooth extractions while they're on Plavix. The dentists seem to think that it's not that big an issue, but I recommend my patients wait until they're out of the range that they should, you know, be on dual antiplatelet therapy. Or if I know something like that is coming up, and we try to ask the patients, listen, do you have anything coming up? Can it be delayed? All of this stuff before we make a stent selection. I'm hoping that by the year 2020, this will all be a moot point because everyone will be getting 1 month of dual antiplatelet therapy with new guidelines. We're not there yet, but I think we at least have some data that suggests if we have to stop it because they're bleeding, we are probably safe. In the periphery.
So that's not an issue of
Again, the legs are a little bit different. They don't tend to thrombose as much as the coronaries do. There is a very, very high rate of restenosis in the legs when you put in a peripheral stent, bare metal or otherwise. A lot of the problem with the leg is where the heart arteries move, but not that much. The leg arteries have big hinge points in them. So putting in stents in the periphery is very, very difficult. You have a high rate of stent fracture, a high rate of restenosis just because of how that stent sits at different hinge points. There's a whole different set of stents, materials, deployment strategies, and they use predominantly nowadays most peripheral interventionalists, I can't speak for the vascular surgeons, we don't have any in the room, but most peripheral interventionalists will pull a drug-coated balloon off the shelf before they pull a stent for a leg. And the reason there, again, is you reduce neointimal thickening, you reduce proliferation, you increase the longevity of what's there. And most of the times, the reason to put a stent in a leg is because you're putting it outside of the lumen of the vessel. So you've created a dissection plane in a chronically occluded vessel, and you're trying to hold that portion of the vessel open. So these things are higher risk to begin with, and it's a completely different animal. All right.